Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2TS. My name is Roy. I am the net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going on for more than 42 years, mostly under the great care of Dick at KQRIW. Fortunately, became a silent T a few years ago. So, in his memory, we continue the tradition, and we take it as an opportunity to learn from each other and to teach each other and to entertain and amuse each other. It's all supposed to be a degree of fun, not supposed to be an argument. So keep that in mind. Let me drop for a second, and then I will return with the usual link. Okay, if you want to reach me and you can't get me on the radio, you can email me. Reasons for that would be either what we used to call mailbag questions. Those were questions that are asked on the technical net, but if you can't be here Sunday night in front of a radio and such, you can email me, and I can try to entertain the question. And even if you can't listen on an audio stream, we have an archive site, and you can display the answer back. Also, if you have any topics for discussion, it could be either topics you would like to do a small presentation on, or topics that you would like to be part of a discussion of, or topics that you would like to sit back and relax and listen to other people talk about it. So that's the reason. Also, if you have any nice technical puzzles, I'm always looking for technical puzzles, preferably those that can't be answered by simply Googling them. They're very rare, they're very valuable to me at least, and I am always looking for them. I haven't found any new ones lately, unfortunately, but I'm always looking, so that's the reason. Or if you'd like me to tap Paul, WS2N, on the shoulder and have him check out some space or NASA-related story and give his take on it, so you could email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Or you could email Paul directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have a whole bunch of very interesting YouTubes and articles and all kinds of fun stuff that I put on my link page. And the link page is available 24/7 for the foreseeable future. I change the page once a year, but I give links to the previous year. So if you're interested in interesting articles in YouTube, just type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. You have a chat room. Sometimes it's active, sometimes it's very, very quiet. You get there by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. I offer an audio stream of this technical net, and because people ask, I leave it on for the rest of the week. It might be a little erratic this week because we're doing some maintenance on the computers and such. But if you type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, that'll bring you the audio stream directly from Glen Oak. Also, remember, my KC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. Has over a million visitors, and it has archived the Limark
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Oops, I guess I was a little too long-winded.
You were talking about Mike's website.
Sorry.
Good evening, WS2N.
Good evening, Paul. Okay, well, everyone knows Mike. He's KC2NJI. And his site is amateurradio.tv. So take a look at it. A lot of very useful archive technical nets, as I said, going back to September of 2006. Anyway, I've mentioned this before. I'll no doubt mention it again. 10 meters is jumping, guys. On top of it just being a very good propagation, good sunspot activity, there was a contest. CQ contest, and I could not. I run a 10-meter net Sunday mornings, usually on 28.380, and I could not find an empty portion of the spectrum to plant myself. No matter where I went, there was QRM from signals nearby. So the entire band was filled and brimming. So if you haven't tried out 10 meters since the sunspot doldrums, consider taking a look at it. It's really active. Anyway, let me drop for a sec. Okay, so like we usually do, we're going to ask for questions, preferably questions of an amateur radio-related technology at first, but as time goes on, anyone with any science-related question is free to ask it. We'll see if we can come up with some kind of a response that helps out. So anyone out there with any questions or comments, people who were here and asked something and went off and tried it and discovered something new and wants to share it with us, please, any of those, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
820ZB.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
WB2KWZ with a medical question.
Very good. I have Craig, I have Rich, and I have Ken. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight?
AD2DU.
Okay, Alex, I have you down in the number 4 position for tonight. Anyone else want to put their name down? I mean, we'll take names later on as well, but, you know, the more the merrier.
Work on timing. Did you get me by chance, Roy? You kind of cut right before you got Paul and Ken in there.
Yes, Craig, I got you first. I have 4 people, Craig, then I have Rich, then I have Ken, then I have Alex. Okay, Jim, we got you down as well. Anyone else want to put their name down before we begin this little segment? Very well. Okay, first up tonight is Craig. Welcome back from Las Vegas. I haven't talked to you since then, so I'm sure you've been back for a while.
Oh, certainly. It's been a fun time. Unfortunately, things were not very good, though, coming home in terms of, I guess, I'm actually not going to bring it up here. I probably brought it up a few times, but I don't want to discuss it here.
Okay, Craig, so what's your question or your comment for tonight, then?
It's always been coming up in my head for a while. I might have asked you this, maybe not. Creating your own app for whatever, is it really simple or kind of difficult to do? Like, you need to hire somebody that's really good with, like, programming and tech and things like that.
Okay, you have to better define the question because, unfortunately, over time, application or app has taken on a much more generalized concept. In my mind, an app is still primarily a cell phone-based little gizmo type of thing. But over time, a software that runs on personal computers are now called apps. So there's a difference between the two. Are you talking about, say, an iOS-based app or an Android-based app, or are you talking more about a PC-based app, IBM PC compatible sort of thing from the past, or Apple app. So which type of an app are we talking about here?
It's an app that could be used for either Apple and Android as far as getting it to be compatibility. Think of it as if you were using YouTube to do live streaming, and I wanted to try and make your own custom live streaming app with all these settings and get like multiple things to work together to be able to stream to YouTube. Can that be done, or is it rather difficult to, considering you need like a really good developer that can like make an app like that?
Yes, you're not really talking about something very simple. You're talking about something very complicated and probably requiring API kits from YouTube so that you can link on to software hooks. And so you have to be somewhat very knowledgeable about how to make those, and YouTube kind of limits third parties' abilities to manipulate. So I don't know the power of the APIs that they offer and the hooks that they offer. They may discourage you from doing it, and you got to go around things. So for stuff like that, you're most likely going to need a developer with some experience with iOS apps, and if you want them to work in Android as well, you'll need even a better guy who can either write for both of them or can write in a third-party code that's translatable between the two. My memory is that there were such third-party programming tools in the past, but I haven't kept up with them, so I don't know if they still work anymore.
WB2KWC?
Yes, Cap.
Okay, I go along with what Roy had said. Just wondering, though, do you, I guess, write the app? Are there existing apps that will do that? Also consider, do you really need to live stream, or can you do video editing app that exists to basically mix and do all of your video effects and then get the output of that, which is probably an MP4 file or you know, some other video format, and upload that to YouTube?
So I watched this, I watched these people that do a lot of Florida live streams once in a while, and people have always been asking them, how are their live streams so perfect without so much frame dropping or whatever, especially if they're on like rides or buildings or whatever? So they told them it would be kind of complicated for them to go over everything, because it's not just loading up an app. There's like a lot of settings that need to be set, and it's not just one app. It's like multiple apps working together, and technically it would take many hours for him to go over everything, and he doesn't really want to give it away, because he spends so much time into it that it would kind of defeat the purpose just to give it away for free and everything. And he even told me that even if he were to send me his app, it actually wouldn't work, because he's recently gotten updates for a brand new app he had made, and so he had to lock his phone to an older system. But yeah, he put like so many hours and hours and hours into it. Like, again, it's not just one app, it's multiple apps, a bunch of settings, and it's just so complicated.
Okay, Craig, I think this is beyond you, beyond most people. Software writing is not rare, but it's a small subset of the population. You know, and different people can handle different degrees. I'm not quite sure if the gentleman you're alluding to wrote any of the software. It sounds like he collected the software and then figured out how to put the pieces together and then how to adjust the settings to optimize for you know, latency error and dropped frames and such. So that's a skill set as much as programming is, but it's a different one. This is not going to be easy unless he kind of tells you, you know, how the meatballs are made. You're not going to be able to replicate it probably by yourself. You might find some guru out there willing to take on the job of replicating. That's going to kind of cost you money, because these guys don't do anything for free. So I don't think it's as simple as just making your own app. Because, again, a lot of these things tend to have proprietary limitations. So you either know how to get around them, or you can license them somehow, or you just use other people's software in creative ways.
I live stream on my phone. I don't like to use YouTube itself, because there are still some things that don't quite work right, like being able to interact with the live chat. You can see people chatting, and you can kind of moderate the chat, but you can't reply to any messages on the chat at all. It's kind of weird. So I like using external software, like Streamlabs, for example, and Prism. Prism's not bad. There are just times where I kind of drop a little bit if I'm in, like, a bad area. But what this guy can do with his app is he can basically just drop the bitrate or go into, like, some kind of made-up mode he made to kind of handle it and still keep the stream going. He's even been able to set it up so that way if he, like, needs to do something off-camera, he can do, like, a be-right-back screen or overlay an existing video in the meantime while the stream is paused without having to, like, cancel the stream and then redo everything. It's kind of interesting how he has his own app to, like, do all of these crazy things. Well, YouTube can't really do that.
Okay, but, yeah, he's using a streaming program. He might have tweaked it. I think OBS is open source, so theoretically you could download the source code and then play around, or you could either write third-party plugins or bind the third-party plugins and insert them in something like either OBS or Streamlabs or Prism or any of those streaming services. So all these streaming services usually have a conduit for places like YouTube. There's a whole bunch of different pieces of software that are designed to do streaming, and one of the first things that they do is get hooked to YouTube. So if the guy wrote it himself, lots of luck. You got a problem. If his basic streaming software is an available one, and it's just a matter of plug-ins, and he could just give you a vague idea, did he write the plugins? If he didn't write the plugins, and if he didn't write whatever streaming program he's using, then it's more of a matter of putting things together in the right order and getting the settings right. Theoretically, a lot easier than writing any of these things. So if you could cajole just out of him, what streaming software does he use? Does he roll his own? Is it someone else's? And what plugin does he like? And at least that'll give you about half the way there.
Well, it's his very own app that he doesn't want to give to anybody because, again, he spends so much time on it, it really would defeat the purpose and it would be so complicated. He'd have to sit at his desk and literally go over everything. And even then, people have no idea what they're exactly looking at, even if they really wanted to develop their own original and creative ways to perfect the live streaming app, because there's a lot of developers that don't really spend time tweaking apps at all and making them look right. As a matter of fact, here's kind of an odd question, and I don't think this could maybe... Well, take an existing live streaming app, for example. Can you actually take it and modify it somehow into your own app if you really wanted to? Like, open it up, like, play around with the debug and, write in your own stuff if you really wanted to?
Yeah, I kind of just mentioned that. OBS, as far as I'm aware still, is open source, and they allow people to download the software, and you can either compile it or you can tweak it and compile it. And that's where Streamlabs got into trouble, because Streamlabs just took OBS and tweaked it and just didn't, they kind of violated the shareware license on it. So that's what got them into a lot of trouble. But it is my understanding that OBS itself is open source. Once it's open source, if you knew how to program, you could modify it to your heart's content.
WB2KW3?
Yes, Ken.
Okay, I guess it depends on how the program is available. If it is a closed source program or even a publicly available program, but the only thing that is available is the binary, the program that is executable on your computer, getting it back to a state that you can modify it would be extremely difficult. If, on the other hand, it's open source, and the person has made the source code, which is humanly readable, available on a platform like GitHub, it would not be that difficult to modify. Now, you have to know what you're doing. Also, open source, there are a number of different licenses that people may publish this software on. Some of them say, oh, okay, you can modify it, do whatever you want. Others say, whatever you have changed, you must make publicly available to the world at large. So, you know, if you want to do something proprietary, you have to take a look at the license that the software is published under.
Okay, thank you, Ken, by the way. This is AC2GF. Now, I just Googled it to make absolutely sure, and it comes up OBS Studio. It says it's a free and open source software for video recording and live streaming. Download and start streaming quickly and easily with Windows, etc., etc. So it's the OBS project. All you have to do is Google OBS open source, and it'll give you places. It's, I think it's located, of course, like most others, on GitHub. As Ken mentioned, there are different open source licenses with different requirements, but you definitely download it and look at it. Now, if you happen to be a programmer, that's very useful, because it is within the realm of possibilities. I would assume it's reasonably well documented in the code source itself. If it wasn't, it would be kind of a waste of time. And you could make modifications. Plus the fact that, as I mentioned, OBS, I know, offer has plugins. So there are software kits to help you in putting together the plugins that do other tasks within OBS. So as Ken mentioned, it is OBS is an open source software product. It gives you the source code. You don't have to decompile the executable, which I wouldn't wish on anyone. But you do need to know how to do programming. And I am not quite sure exactly what language they use to program OBS. So that would be kind of important, if it was, say, C++ or Python or what. So that's a variable I can't quite tell you yet.
Cousin that maybe might be able to do something like this. Much as how much money it would cost, I would like to have my own app. So, technically open to the public, that benefits you, then you have to make it available to everybody else. But if you basically designed your own private app and you wanted to change something that better benefits you, then technically, since you're the one that made it, if you only want it available to you, you don't have to distribute it to everybody.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is on the honor system. No one's going to hunt you down and hurt you. If you're not going to publish it to other people, they won't even know that you did anything. I doubt that the code kind of sends a call back to mama when a modified version of it is running someplace on the internet. I think that's a little bit too 1984-ish. You could, again, if either you know how to program or you have someone you know who knows how to program, it is theoretically possible to tweak it, change it, all manner of different things. I used to do that when I was a wee bit younger and interested in learning how to program in C at the time. So I downloaded C-Source and took it apart, put it back together, and did a bunch of things with it. So it just, you know, requires time and the inclination to do that. Because writing software, you know, is easy for some and very difficult for others.
If I get the chance, maybe I'll give them a little talk to and see maybe if I could try to figure something out. It's just a thought. I probably don't want to do it, considering how time-consuming it would probably be, but I would like to have something strictly for myself at some point, because I know a lot of professional people that do have their own apps for live streaming that are so perfect they don't really want to give it to everybody. So that's why they just focus on, that's why they let everybody just have the regular default stuff, like Camera 5, YouTube, Streamlabs, and Prism. So maybe I could work something out. All right, that's it for now. Thank you. ACQGF Net Control, G2O.
Okay, Craig, I wish you good luck. Strikes me as a great deal of extra work. And you also have to keep in mind that places like YouTube will change how they accept things and be prepared to have to tweak the final app over time, because nothing stays the same. They'll upgrade their system in a way and probably bring it back. Unfortunately, I'm not frozen in amber. They don't stay fresh. They don't stay on the back of the park. Okay, good. Good luck if you ever do plan to do something along those lines and you have some experience. Come back and tell us about it. So let's go. Next on our list is Rich of 2DZ. How are you, Rich, and what's your question for tonight?
Good evening, Roy, and good evening, everybody. The question is about a tri-band theme and how it works. Is the driven element basically a dipole, and then you have the director and you have another element, and how do they work? And why is it that, I guess for HF, you don't see more than a tri-band or a three-element beam, where for UHF, you know, you can get up to 10 elements or more. What do the elements actually do? I know they capture the wave somehow, but could you explain it a little bit more? Specifically how a Yagi works?
Okay. Are you talking with traps or without traps?
Without traps.
Okay, that's a good question, and fortunately, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I'd be interested in the people out there. As far as I'm aware, multi-band Yagis are work with traps. Anyone out there know of Yagis, multi-band Yagis that operate without any traps?
CBH with a comment.
Yes, John.
As a rule, when you're going multi-band, you have traps which are essentially parallel resonant circuits. So when you hit the resonant frequency, it cuts the element for that length. And, the center element, usually the driven element, would have a trap in it to cut it to a different length, depending on what band you want to operate on. But if it's a mono-band Yagi, usually there are no tracks. Usually there are three elements, the driven element, a director, and the reflector. The director is shorter than the front, and the reflector is longer than the back.
Okay, John, but my question is, the multi-band Yagis I am aware of operating in the basic principle, as I understand the Yagis, is that there is one driven element, and that driven element works pretty much like a dipole. Then, as you mentioned, you have a slightly larger element behind it, which reflects the RF being emitted forward, and you have a slightly shorter element, parasitic
not detect anything exploding. It interacts with the RF to produce a phase disruption that causes the signal to go tighter in the forward direction. So the director drives it forward, the reflector bounces it back to the front, and the only way that you can have multiple bands is by using a trap to change the length of both the reflector director and the emitting driven element to whatever length is required for different resonances. So if you wanted to have a two-band beam, you could have one trap on either side of all the three elements in your Yagi. If you wanted to have a three-band, you would need to have two traps on either side of all the elements, because you need to somehow get both the reflector, the driver, and the driven element to be of a resonant length. And the easiest way of doing it, something like a Yagi, is a trap that at some frequency allows the RF to flow through it. Other times, it's not.
That's absolutely correct. If you look in the handbook, for example, and look at some of the monoband Yagis, the monoband only for one band, you will see no traps on them. It's the multiple band Yagis that will have traps, which are essentially parallel resonant circuits, that when they resonate, of course, they act like an open circuit, so they cut the element at that point.
Wesley recognized and Ken recognized. Wesley, go first, then Ken.
And the reflector, it needs to be longer. Why does that reflect? You know, just by shortening a long or lengthening a piece of aluminum or steel, why does that one reflect and one reflects backwards and one reflects forwards?
Okay, Rich. By the way, Ken recognized and Wesley recognized. We'll get to you in a minute now. This is where it gets esoteric. What happens is the famous Yagi UDA antenna for UDA gets dropped almost all the time. They invented it in Japan, and I think it came to be known around World War II and such. It has to do, unfortunately, elements that are not wired into your transmission line are parasitic elements, and if you build them for a certain distance and a certain length, they will reflect a phase-shifted signal when they come in contact in the near field with the driven element's emission. So if you build it a little bit longer, you can get the phase shift to work out so that there is positive interference going in one direction as opposed to the other. If you build it a little long, the phase difference gives you positive interference going forward, bouncing off the back and going back forward. And in the director, the phase difference gives you a positive interference again going forward. So that's why. The reasons why a paralytic element has a phase shift is a little bit on the esoteric side, but ultimately it has to do with an adjusted phase of the reflected RF coming from the driven element to the reflector, which pushes it in one direction, and the director that pushes it in the same forward direction.
So the question would be, would you consider the periodic as Yagi? A few words about it. We have The most common, which is LPDA, it consists of halfway dipole driven elements, and we have zigzag V-type slot and dipole, and mostly you see look for your configuration. But it is multi-element directional antenna designed to operate over a wide band of frequencies. By the way, there was John Dulwee, right, in 1952, I believe, right, who made this antenna first. And that actually is more than two bands.
Yes, I agree with you, but they're not Yagi. Log periodics are very interesting antennas. They are multi-band. They are not as directional as Yagi. And they use active driven elements. They don't use a single driven element. So it's a different antenna design with different pluses and minuses. I believe that when Rich was asking the question, I got the impression he was talking about Yagi primarily.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Ken, you wanted to say something on this?
Yes, I did. First of all, to answer the question that hasn't been answered yet, is the reason that HF are usually only two or three elements is simply because of the size. The size of the element and the size of the boom is dependent on the frequency of the radio or the actual wavelength being handled. So, you know, imagine a 2 meter antenna. Let's say you're using a quarter wave. You're talking about a half a meter, roughly, 19 inches, as opposed to, let's say, a 20 meter antenna, which a quarter wave would be 5 meters. So you've got quite a bit of distance, difference. And there is one antenna, I think it's a Yagi, that is multi-band and does not require taps, and that is the STEP-IR, which essentially physically changes the length of the elements rather than doing it electrically like traps do. AC2GS,
WB2KW6. AC2GS, well, yeah, and I'm a big fan of STEP-IR. We talked about STEP-IR about 6-7 months ago. The person I was talking with it thought it was a mechanical horror show. I talked to other guys on the West Coast who had STEP-IRs, and they love them. But that's kind of fudging things because it is not in a static way a multi-band antenna. It is a mechanically adjustable driver. So in the same way that traps will change the effective length, it isn't that they electronically change the non-mechanical length, but they actually do cut off at certain resonant frequencies and make effectively the element length shorter or longer based on what frequency you send them. But I guess if this was law court and such, yes, a STEP-IR is a multi-band Yagi, but it is an incredibly special case. Again, it is a wondrous device where the driven elements and the reflector and the director all change dimension. With a stepper motor, threading out a conductive material from a hub. So, very fascinating design. I think someone in Europe ripped them off and sells a similar product in Europe. Rather expensive. If I had an antenna farm, that would probably be my go-to multi-phasic power array.
Oh, yes. I was not saying that it was your typical Yagi, but it kind of falls in the ballpark there. And I guess my question to Rich is, are you really talking about Yagi, or are you talking about a directional antenna and just use the term Yagi?
Okay, and I thought a Yagi was a directional antenna.
Yes, a Yagi is a directional antenna, but so is the log periodic that Wesley mentioned. You know, if you looked at them, well, I guess you'd see probably more elements on a log periodic. But, you know, both of them are directional antennas. You could put them up on a mast and, you know, use a rotator to beam your signal to wherever you'd like.
Now, I was specifically asking about Yagis, not variations, you know, like log periodics or whatever. Just about Yagis. I never knew how the director and the reflector interacted with the driven element, and I thought the driven element was nothing more than a dipole, so Roy confirmed that, and now I have a better idea of how a beam works.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
I like to think of it like this. If you have the dipole, and now your reflector is larger. Well, let's say the reflector was a dish. The dish would be parasitic too. That's not tied into the dipole. That would act as a reflector. So the dish, is, of course, would be larger. So that would it doesn't allow the signal to go in that direction. It keeps everything going in the forward direction. So now instead of the dish, you have that wire that's maybe 5% longer. And that wire acts as the, again, that's not a reflector. So instead of a dish there, you have a wire, and that's pushing the signal forward. Then you have the director in the front that's shorter. The dipole in the middle is also energizing that director. Direct is shorter, so the signal from the dipole is going to go forward. It's going to go past the director because the director is shorter. If it was longer, it would stop it. It would try to stop it just like the reflector is. So it's shorter, so your signal is going to go forward. It's also energizing that director. The director actually, I mean, if you were to check the voltage on the director, it's now energized. Even so, you know, it's being energized from the dipole. Now that since that thing is energized, the director is looking back at the dipole part. The dipole part is actually about 5% longer than the director. So it's almost acting similar to the first set. You know, that forward one, the director is energized, and it's using the dipole as a reflector. If you had more in front of it, the same would hold true. Each one would be a little shorter, and you would get more and more directionality going forward. I'm not sure if that's exactly right, but that's the way I think of it. I think that's what the question is really about. What do you think, Roy? Back to you.
No, that's a very good way of explaining it, and it doesn't confuse people by just talking about the phase shifts that occur with the reflections from the paralytic elements, because they all have to absorb the energy and reflect it back. But it, you know, having each previous element act as a relative reflector for the next parasitic element is a nice way of doing it. Just to touch on what Ken mentioned earlier that I didn't touch on, the reason why you see three elements, HF, Yagis, and you see 10 and 12 and whatever element, UHF, VHF, is, as you mentioned, it's the mechanical problem. To build something mechanically with a long enough mass to make a difference so that you could put multiple directors. You know, your poor rotor would burn out very quickly. I think some guy, I think in Japan, has some kind of 80-meter Yagi that he has to change the rotors on twice a year.
So it's a mechanical aspect that as these things get smaller and smaller, you could make them longer and longer. There's a diminishing return with everything. With reflectors, there's an immediate diminishing return. There's no real value in adding another reflector behind the first reflector. So almost all Yagis that I know of, there probably is a few that have two reflectors, but usually it's one reflector. And then if you have a mass long enough and you arrange the directors, you can get a narrower and narrower beam, and you can get a higher and higher directional signal. Any comments? Gosh, have we burnt out that question?
Boy, I had some noise covering up. Did you ask me a question?
I was just asking if anyone had anything further to say about this. I mean, since you brought it up, if it makes all sense for you and you don't have any questions about it, that's fine, but I was just checking in to make sure.
No, it's much more clear now. Much more clear. And is it also the reason that they don't have, you know, it's usually a tri-bander with three elements. I don't think I've ever seen a Yagi for HF that has four elements. Is that because of the weight of it, you know, and the mechanical pressure it would have on the rotor and whatever? Or you'd think that adding another element wouldn't change things that much, but I don't think I've ever seen a four-element Yagi for HF.
Yes, theoretically you could do it, and you would have better gain. And then you would have mechanical problems, and your four-element Yagi would break more often than anyone's three-element Yagi, and your rotor would crack its bearing faster than anyone who has a three. So it's more about the relative size of lower high-frequency Yagis than UHF VHF, where these things are very light. I have a 2 meter Yagi that has, I think, 10 elements. It's just bracketed there, and it's very light because it's 2 meters. It's not 40 meters, God forbid. So yeah, it's just a mechanical problem. As you increase directors, you will increase gain, but you will increase weight and wind bearing and all kinds of nasty things.
Okay. I got it now. Now I understand how it works. Thanks to all. Back to you, Roy.
You're welcome, Rich. Next up is Ken, WB2KWC. What's your question or your comment for tonight, Ken?
Okay. Thank you, Roy. I'm curious about the size of the COVID virus. Oh, no, we're back to COVID. I am in the habit of wearing a KN95 mask when indoors with groups of people. One of my friends tells me that what I'm doing is futile. Her logic is that if I'm in an elevator with someone that has gas, I can smell it through the mask. Maintains that if the mask does not stop flatulence, it will not stop COVID. I believe that COVID is physically larger than methane gas and could be stopped by a mask, but I'm not sure, so I figured I would ask someone with greater knowledge than I have.
Okay, Ken, I kind of vaguely remember this from a year or a year and a half ago, but you're quite right. Organic compounds that produce foul odors are much, much smaller than any virus. Viruses are made out of thousands of atoms. Odoriferous molecules are usually made out of 5 or 6. So the size of a COVID virus is bigger. Also, it usually doesn't travel dry. It usually travels on spittle. So that increases the size dramatically. If you had dry single COVID viral particles, you could possibly make a case that K95s are porous enough to let them go through, but the overwhelming majority are not dried single viral particles. They're spittle-enhanced globs of viruses, and for the most part, they will protect people. So, organic chemicals are completely different than viruses. They're orders of magnitude smaller.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
At the risk of being somewhat indecent here, it is not the methane itself that is the foul odor. It's actually, as you mentioned, the hydrogen. The hydrogen sulfide is one of the primary components that that adds the foulness. Go ahead.
Yes, sulfur molecules can be particularly dank. There's a lot of variations on sulfur that sink to high heaven. And there are a lot of other gases that permeate through your intestines as breakdown products of anaerobic metabolism that your gut is full of. And as a byproduct, they produce all kinds of nasty things. But they were all, again, incredibly small. There's pretty much, other than a gas mask, with carbon filters and such, there's any kind of paper or filtration, a device that lets you breathe properly is going to let through those nasty gases, but not viral particles, thankfully. Any other questions or comments on this particular subject? Okay, I guess not. I guess we'll move on to our next person, which is Alan, 82DU. What can we do for you today, Alan?
Hey, Doctor. I have a quick comment, quick question. I finally got an HF antenna set up on the roof today. Didn't have time to do the one I wanted, but I threw up the Slinktenna by Quirky QRP, which is a little slinky inside a tiny PVC pipe. Used it with a FT891 Z100A tuner and was not expecting much at all. It was my first time really trying out HF in that sense. The thing, I was talking to somebody in Portugal, in the Madeira Islands, that was blown away by how far the slinky went. 82 to you.
What band was that on? Alex, did you hear me? I asked, what band is that on, that you talked to Portugal?
14.265, so I guess that's 20 meters?
Yep, that's 20 meters. Congratulations. I mean, Slinktenna is not exactly what I would call, something that you dream about, like I do my Sepper IR stack phase array of Yagis and such. But, ultimately, if it gets you someplace, then it works. I often tell the story of a guy who later went on to manufacture proper antennas that just as a lark. According to his story, he said that he took a 100-watt light bulb, put it on a 4 or 6 foot lamp fence post, and used it as his antenna, and ended up with a workable state certificate just putting a lot of effort into it. So a surprising number of antennas that shouldn't really work too well, work well enough. Dick, K2RIW, used to tell a story, and I always forget the name of the other guy, who apparently had an antenna that was just a piece of wire sitting on the ground that ultimately most people would tell you that thing would be worthless. And yet he was able to make all kinds of contact with it. So I congratulate you that your Slinktenna works for you. I hope you get a lot more out of it in the time to come. But, you know, eventually I'm sure you're going to try out other antennas. You know, propagation can change on a dime. Sometimes all you need is a hanger out there, and sometimes even if you have that stepper phased array, you're not going to hear anything. So, you know, it's one part luck, one part technology, and I'm glad it worked out for you.
Yeah, I was fantastically surprised because it's going to fit into a go bag. It's going to fit into like a briefcase to have a full radio setup. But my question, I'm sure this is going to take 2 seconds to answer. If I'm putting the power wire into the, I forget what you call it, the power thing, the switching alternator or whatever, it starts to fray on the end. Are you supposed to solder the end? So, like, how do you keep it from not fraying? 82 to you.
Okay. Not 100% sure what you're alluding to, but generally speaking, if you're going to have open stranded wires and you're going to need to connect them to things, it's always good to give them a good tight twist and then a couple of drops of solder melt into it, so it kind of bonds it to a single wire, so it's much less likely to become frayed or deformed. Yes, Ed.
If it's truly bare copper, absolutely. If it's, you know, magnet wire with that enamel coating, not that simple.
Well, but Ed, his wire is stranded. I've never seen I've never seen that. Did they make that?
It's not common, but I've seen it. But just want to make sure you're not the odd man out with the problem wire.
Okay, but it's just the way that Alex presented it sounds like it's just standard, wire, because he's plugging it into things. So if it was enameled, he'd have problems plugging it into things as it is. So I think it's probably just regular, uncoated stranded wire, and a simple dab with a soldering iron will fix that up entirely. And in addition to people out there, if you ever work with guy ropes and such, it's also a good idea. The edges will kind of unravel often. So what I do is I set the edges on fire for a second and have them melt together so it bonds them well and they don't kind of slowly unravel.
Boy Scouts are very big on ripping ropes for that very reason. Sometimes you use a fine cord. Sometimes you can use electrical tape. Sometimes you can just dip them in glue. And if it's plastic, yeah, sometimes you just heat them up till it melts and runs together. But don't try that with cotton.
No, I haven't. But for my guy ropes, I think I've done them all, and they're all some variation of plastics, and I've seen it in more than enough YouTube, so it works fine. I didn't start a fire.
Wonderful thing, but not to start a fire where you don't want it.
That is quite true. I remember burning things with magnifying glasses when I was a little kid, and fortunately I didn't burn myself or anyone else. And I didn't burn ants. I know that for some odd reason, children have this tendency to do that to ants. I was never inclined to burn little bits and pieces of paper and be fascinated by it all.
What shadow does it turn out?
KG2RY.
David recognized? I don't know. I'm probably the only one here who took an oath by Apollo to do no harm. Most other people listening tonight have not been required to do that. Okey-dokey. David, what can I do for you?
Good evening. First, I want to say that you can fry an egg with a magnifier. Second, I want to say that I have a question. If you can put me in the list, thank you very much.
Yes, indeed, David. Consider yourself on the list. So, Alex, did we answer your question? Do you have anything else you want to ask?
You did answer my question. That's very helpful. It's the stock power wires going to the power supply with the Yaesu and the Icon.